From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. The United States can replace all oil and coal by the year 2050 without nuclear power, new federal taxes or subsidies, or new inventions, and at the same time, grow the U.S. economy by 158%. That's according to energy expert Amory Lovins, but is it true? You may remember our conversation with Amory Lovins in December about his book, Reinventing Fire. You can hear the entire interview at KUOW.org. Well, it was such a huge look at this issue. We thought we'd want to come back and explore some of those ideas with Casey Golden. He's the policy director for the Seattle-based group Climate Solutions. They focus on solving the problems of climate change by making changes here in the Northwest. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be on, Ross.
So Amory Lovins, who was sitting right there, is a real environmental optimist, it sounds like. He says it's economically and technologically feasible to make this change away from fossil fuels to clean energy and in a fairly short length of time. To that part of his assertion, do you agree?
I do, at least in part because we have to. It's not optional. I think sometimes we think of this transition from fossil fuels to clean energy as something that would be nice to do. But as the reality of the climate crisis starts to set in, and we've seen an awful lot of that in the last year, it becomes clear that we have to make that transition. And I think having someone like Amory out there who really stretches the art and science of the possible and helps people imagine how we would get there is a tremendously valuable thing. It's part of how we develop a roadmap to get there.
Well, one technological solution that Amory Lovins points to is how we produce our cars.
Two-thirds of the energy it takes to move a typical automobile is caused by its weight. So the most important thing you can do to save energy is to take out obesity. Because we've had an epidemic of it. Our two-ton steel cars have gained weight for the quarter century twice as fast as we have. But we can now take out half or two-thirds of that weight while improving safety by using modern ultra-light, ultra-strong materials like the carbon fiber composites that the Dreamliner is half made of.
Casey, do you think that these kind of changes in just the material we make our vehicles out of has such a huge potential for changing the way that we consume fuel?
Absolutely. And, you know, Boeing has staked its competitive position on that proposition by building the most efficient planes in the world. And I think you'll start to see the auto industry follow suit. I don't know if Amory knew this, but some of the carbon fiber that BMW is now going to introduce into their cars is being manufactured over in Moses Lake. I think that is an important part of the future of the automotive industry. And you got to love Amory's capacity for the perfect quip. This idea of automotive obesity is really true. You know, I just as somebody who occasionally drives around in Seattle, having to haul around, you know, 4,000 pounds of steel in order to get my 200-pound body from point A to point B can't be the best way to get that done. And Amory's pointing to a better way.
Well, he doesn't dismiss the idea of mass transit by any means. Yeah. He writes quite a bit about that. But if we make cars so much lighter that they're much easier and less expensive to run, doesn't that continue us in the car economy? In other words, can we get to a post-oil future when we're still driving a lot of cars, even if they are lightweight cars?
That is a really good point. I don't by any means mean to exclude the importance of other forms of transportation, from walking to biking to mass transit. Those all have to come on at the same time. We think of them sort of as the three legs of the stool of the energy transition for transportation: is cleaner vehicles, cleaner fuels, and better alternatives to vehicles. And again, when you look at the size of the climate and carbon challenge and the speed with which it's coming on, we need all three of those legs big time.
Well, one of the interesting things I thought about what Amory Lovins was telling us is that to do away with oil and coal completely by 2050 is he doesn't talk about government action. In fact, he doesn't see any one government policy particularly being necessary, although he does say that there is one way that government could nudge us in the right direction.
The FEBATE means rebates for efficient new autos of whatever type and size you want, paid for by corresponding fees on inefficient ones of the same type and size. So it's revenue neutral, it's size neutral, but it broadens the price spread by maybe thousands of dollars between the most and least efficient autos of each kind.
He's talking about this nudge idea, and he thinks it's likely to happen at the state level. What do you think about the idea, and what do you think about the feasibility of it being adopted state by state?
It's a terrific idea. It's a tweak, not a revolution, but it's a tweak in the right direction. A few states have experimented with it. They've run into some problems with federal preemption on fuel economy, but I know that there are some folks continuing to think about how to advance it at the state level. It's a good idea. But the reason I point to it being a tweak is, and this is a place where my perspective probably differs a little bit from Amory, I do think we need strong public policy. I appreciate the fact that Amory sort of keeps his niche and his pitch in a sort of post-political or trans-political place. I think there's a huge value in that. But I don't think we can make this transition quickly enough and effectively enough without regaining our control of our democracy from fossil fuel interests, who have systematically blocked development of alternatives for years, and getting in place some stronger public policies that make for a fair competition between clean energy and fossil fuels.
He makes the transitions leapfrog over all these issues that you and I've spent time talking about, what things government can do and how public policy can change our behavior. You think he might be a little bit too optimistic about the economy naturally moving in that direction?
I'm glad he's optimistic. I don't begrudge him one bit. And I think it's terrific. I think what he's doing is suspending the reality of our political condition in order to bring people's minds to the place about what we could really do if we put our minds to it, technologically and economically. I think that's a tremendously valuable service. I think it helps us redouble our commitment to resolve some of the political obstacles to getting that stuff done. Having said all that, the political obstacles remain, and they need to be removed.
We're talking about some big ideas, Amory Lovin's new book, Reinventing Fire, a plan for the United States to replace all oil and coal by the year 2050 without a lot of big government policies, without nuclear power, without new federal taxes. He also says that the demand for coal in the United States is waning significantly.
We can already see this. In the U.S., coal has lost a third of its market in 6 years because it's cheaper to do efficiency, renewables, and gas than to run existing coal plants.
And he seems to be suggesting that we shouldn't be too worried because the demand for coal is naturally going away, at least in this country. And of course, you're one of the leaders in the movement to try to stop exporting coal from Washington State ports, a plan to bring them in here via rail from Wyoming, et cetera. Do you think there's any concern for this, or will the demand just naturally peter out?
It won't naturally peter out at the rate that it should, because even though it makes economic sense to make the transition from coal to cleaner resources, that doesn't mean it maximizes the profits of the fossil fuel industry. And the fossil fuel industry still has an enormous amount of control over our democracy. So they are going to hang on to the profits that come from squeezing those last drops of fossil fuel out of the ground as long as they possibly can. Now, the smart ones are also going to hire Amory so they can start thinking about what are they going to do when the gig is finally up. And some of them do. And that's good. Some of them will reemerge as energy companies instead of fossil fuel companies, and the rest of them will die. But none of them, that will happen as quickly as it needs to in order to prevent climate disruption unless we remove some of these political obstacles and get a stronger public policy in place.
Casey Golden from Climate Solutions, I think I've heard you say that you agree with part of what he said. The demand for coal is dying out in this country. Why aren't those same economic forces taking place in China and other places that still want that coal?
If I could, Ross, just to say, sitting in this studio, the demand for coal has been reduced to zero. Seattle phased out its coal plant. Washington State is in the process of phasing out its last coal plant. Oregon isn't far behind. So, yes, the demand is dropping because we are figuring out better ways to meet our energy needs. That is also happening in Asia as they develop their clean energy resources. But the key difference is that they are growing so fast that they're doing more of everything than we are. They're developing coal, they're developing renewable resources, they're developing efficiency, they're investing hand over fist in everything they can because they're trying to bring hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Those choices that are made in Asia about what kind of energy infrastructure investments they make are the biggest single factor globally in determining whether we can avoid catastrophic climate change or not. And that's why we're so determined to stop this ill-conceived coal export scheme, which would just funnel more cheap coal into their economy in ways that tip the balance away from clean energy and toward more coal investment.
You don't think we can look in the future and project a decline in that demand from Asia the same way that we are here? It's still going to go up?
In the distant future, these are all fossil fuels. They're right. Limited. And in Asia as well, their growth curves will level off, and they will discover, as we are, that there's better ways to meet our energy needs. The problem with that is by the time that happens, I mean, literally in the next 5 to 10 years, if the fast-growing Asian economies invest in coal-fired power infrastructure to serve another billion people, we will sail past any safe limit for carbon pollution in the atmosphere, and we will be living in a century of catastrophic climate disruption. So while it might be nice to sort of wait for the slow arcs of technology to take over, we honestly don't have the time or the money to spend the next 5 years moving in the wrong direction. By that time, it'll be too late.
Amory Lovins was talking to us a lot about market forces moving the country away from fossil fuels.
It's really clear now that oil has become uncompetitive even at low prices before it becomes unavailable even at high prices, just like happened to whale oil in the 1850s. And the whalers were astounded to run out of customers before they ran out of whales. And therefore, this transition is inexorable. Driven by existing technology and requiring no act of Congress.
I don't recall any acts of Congress to stop the use of whale oil. So he seems to be implying that it's we've got the analogous situation today. What do you think?
Whale oil wasn't threatening the health of the global economy or slamming superstorms into New Jersey.
Not good for whales,
New York,
but at the same time.
Right, exactly. You know, I hope that people will interpret what Amory's saying in the following way. What he's saying is it makes economic sense to make this transition. But to suggest that it will happen by itself just because it makes economic sense is to misunderstand and underestimate the political power of the fossil fuel industry. Again, just because it makes economic sense for you and me does not mean that the coal and oil industries are going to let go of their subsidies, are going to continue to pay for bad climate science to convince us that we don't need a climate policy, are going to continue to want free dumping of their carbon into the atmosphere where we pay the cost of the effects of that carbon. Amory's analysis is terrific for exposing the economics. Now we have to deal with the politics that stand in the way of good economics.
Why aren't these economics that are kicking in elsewhere kicking in on the energy companies? Why aren't they sort of seeing the economic opportunities that many see to moving away from oil and coal?
Some of them are, but in some cases, you know, they have big long-term irreversible capital investments in the equipment and the technology and the fuel resources that they have now. And so they, you know, understandably want to squeeze as much profit out of what they've already invested as they can before they start making their new investments. So they have an economic incentive to prolong fossil fuel dependence long past the point where it is economic for the rest of us.
We've been talking about some reactions to the Amory Lovins interview. It's at our website, kuow.org. While you're with me, Casey, your group is called Climate Solutions. And in his inaugural address, President Obama talked about three different priorities. And one of those priorities was climate change. First of all, tell us how you think he did his first 4 years. And tell us, do you think he'll be different in the coming 4 years?
You know, Ross, I've tried to become less of a pundit and more of an advocate. I find that people in the political class and in the advocacy community value their ability to predict political outcomes a little bit too much. And I've learned that my ability to predict political outcomes isn't all that good.
I don't want you to predict politics. I kind of want you to evaluate from a climate solutions perspective. Yeah. Has he gotten as close to climate solutions? Yeah. And is anything he said thus far, he's made climate change a big thing? Are there any specifics there that you think will actually lead us forward?
That's a really fair point. Yeah. We were very encouraged by the language of the inauguration speech. He fused the moral imperative to deal with climate with the economic opportunity to transition our economy away from fossil fuels. I think that connection is the vital connection that can help propel us forward. So the rhetoric was terrific. I fully believe he is personally committed to it. in the first 4 years, he ran into some political obstacles that prevented the kind of progress we need. And I think we all have to take a hard look at how we failed to get where we need to go. I think lack of aggressive presidential leadership was part but not all of that. Certainly dysfunction in the United States Senate was a huge part of that. I heard a story earlier today on NPR about the attempt at filibuster reform recently in the Senate. I got to say, you know, the politics of climate and energy are one thing, but the United States Senate right now has locked itself into knots that prevent it from taking on any big, tough problems. And so I think part of what we need to address ourselves to is this structural dysfunction in our political institutions if we're going to hope to have a good climate policy.
A huge problem there that President Obama is going to have to deal with for the next 4 years. But what would suggest to you that he is taking an aggressive stance? What policy change could he propose that would tell you he's serious?
Here's how we'll measure it. I am not prepared to give up on Congress. Nobody should let them off the hook for doing their job. On the other hand, nobody can look at that situation and be sanguine that they're about to produce some huge breakthrough. They're stuck. We got to keep pushing him. In the meantime, the president has an enormous amount of executive authority to move this forward. The two first and most important things that will test his will and his commitment are whether he rejects the Keystone Pipeline, as we must if we're going to hope to avoid making those big capital investments that sort of send us sailing past the safe climate limits.
And briefly remind us what the Keystone Pipeline
is. Keystone Pipeline would carry unconventional, heavy, very dirty oil from the tar sands in Canada, in Alberta, down through Nebraska and the U.S. to refineries on the Gulf Coast. It would be mostly for export. But this tar sand development is absolutely one of the unconditional no-nos if we're serious about climate change.
You had a second
one? That's
one
thing. The second thing is the EPA has the authority and the obligation under existing law, under the Clean Air Act, to put limits on climate pollution from existing power plants. That rulemaking will go forward now. There's lots of good ways to do it. There's good ways to do it economically. As Amory said, the economics of moving off of coal are very sound, and the administration's going to need a lot of determination to do that. The one other one that I would add that's of particular interest in the Pacific Northwest, the Bonneville Power Administration supplies 75% of the high-voltage transmission in the region. It is a huge public carbon-free energy infrastructure, providing about 10,000 megawatts of power. It's a huge economic backbone of the Pacific Northwest. It is part of the Federal Department of Energy. And I think one of the huge opportunities is for the administration, our elected leaders here in the state, and our congressional delegation to get on the same page about the Bonneville Power Administration being a terrific launching pad and tool to use in accelerating the transition from fossil fuels to clean energy.
Casey Golden, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming by. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ross. My pleasure.
It's KUOW, Seattle.